BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, welcome to 5 Live Science. I'm Chris Smith from The Naked Scientist. And in today's programme, how viruses make their victims smell more attractive to the mosquitoes that transmit them. We hear about a new way of managing pain that doesn't involve drugs. And we venture into the metaverse to see what you can actually do there. Plus,
wherever you've got people moving over large distances in, you know, very rapidly, then you can see the transfer of infectious diseases.
We're putting emerging infections like monkeypox and COVID-19 under the microscope.
The Naked Scientists on 5 Live.
Infection with the mosquito-borne disease dengue, or its close relative Zika virus, alters a person's smell and makes them become more attractive to mosquitoes, boosting the spread of the disease, a new study has found. The Chinese team have shown that when mice pick up a dengue or a Zika infection, the viruses temporarily alter their immune systems so that the spectrum of bacteria growing on the skin changes, and that alters the body odour. The change boosts the output of chemicals that mosquitoes use as a signal to find their next meal. Leslie Vossel works on mosquito attraction at the Rockefeller University in New York, and she gave me her opinion on the new paper.
What they show, which is what we have been looking for in our field for centuries, is an explanation for how viruses manipulate mosquitoes and humans to make it easier for mosquitoes to find humans. They infect mice with Zika or dengue and show that the virus changes the composition of the skin bacteria to make those animals much more attractive to mosquitoes. And so in a way, the virus is changing the composition of the body odor to lure mosquitoes, which makes it easier then for the virus to hop between mosquitoes and an animal host. And so this has huge implications for how viruses move back and forth between people and mosquitoes, and provides a sort of an entry point to figure out how can we make this not happen.
How does the virus do that? How does it actually change the composition of the microbiome? What's going on?
The virus has figured out how to interfere with the warfare between the microbiome and the human skin. What they're doing is manipulating this antimicrobial that would normally sort of prune back the garden of bacteria. And then as a result, you get this huge increase in the microbiome, and then the microbiome can increase the overall smelliness of the host.
And it's the smelliness that then attracts the mosquito.
What they say is exactly that the virus playing with the composition of the skin microbiome is vastly increasing the smell. What I find remarkable is that it comes down to a single molecule. So you increase the amounts of acetophenone from the skin, and then that by itself is able to increase attraction.
Do we see other infections doing a similar sort of thing, or is this the first time we've really got a handle on how diseases can manipulate the way we smell and therefore our attractiveness to biting insects?
What's amazing about the paper is that they didn't just leave it at dengue. They also showed that the same mechanism is happening for Zika, which is great. So sort of double their work and double the impact. So there are many other RNA viruses that infect Aedes mosquitoes, and they haven't studied those here. It would be interesting to see if chikungunya or yellow fever has this effect. Sort of going off of your question, there's a little bit of data showing that people who are infected with malaria pathogens become much more attractive to mosquitoes.
And now we know that this happens. Can we come in at the other end of the argument and say, well, we know this is happening. It's making the mosquitoes want to bite people. Do we understand how it does that to the mosquito? And are there prospects for being able to intervene in that process to stop mosquitoes being attracted by these substances and therefore break chains of transmission of these diseases?
Mm-hmm. Right. So first of all, this paper is a tour de force of biology. What everybody wants to know is, okay, this is fine. It's a great paper. How do I prevent from getting bitten? I don't want to get bitten by mosquitoes. And so there is a bit of a message of hope in this paper. So, and the logical chain would be as follows. So acetophenone makes us more attractive to mosquitoes. The mechanism in the mosquito is that they pay attention to human body odor. They use that information to hunt. And so if acetophenone is a major signal that lures mosquitoes to us, what they say in the paper is, of course, if you manipulate the host, the skin microbiome, to produce less acetophenone, you should be less hunted by mosquitoes. And so, you know, one possible application is that we have mechanisms, skin creams that will reduce the colonization of bacteria that produce acetophenone, for instance. So it's difficult to manipulate the biology of the mosquito to change how they think about us. It's much easier to manipulate us, to manipulate our skin, to make us less smelly in ways that would attract mosquitoes to us.
Leslie Vossel commenting on a recent paper by Gong Cheng from Tsinghua University in China and out this week in the journal Cell. The way we tend to manage pain is by giving people pills to take. Now, that's often an excellent strategy in the short term, but for people with chronic, long-term pain conditions, it's often much less ideal. And drugs all have side effects, of course, and they're often more likely to manifest the longer a drug gets used. So is there a better way? Well, as he explains to Julia Ravey, Northwestern University's John Rogers thinks there is, with an implantable device that harmlessly cools down nerves in the painful area, numbing the discomfort.
It's a pretty basic effect, actually. Anybody who's been out in cold weather and you have your hands exposed to cold, you'll notice your fingertips become numb. You lose a tactile sensation. And so the idea is to just exploit that basic effect, but allow that cooling to be delivered in a targeted way to nerves that are deep in the body, not just those that are near the surface of the skin and the fingers, and to target those nerves that are carrying pain signals relevant to a specific patient condition. And so what we've been able to do is to create a soft cuff-type structure that encircles a targeted region of a particular peripheral nerve. And the consequence of the reduced temperatures that follow from the action of that device is that you literally just block the ability of those pain signals to pass through that region of the peripheral nerve, and you can create this numbing effect.
How did you test if these devices are effective at providing pain relief?
Ultimately, you know, in order to show the ability of the devices to work in the targeted manner, you know, we need to do animal model experiments. And so we've used rodent models, rat models, for those in vivo studies. And we can test the magnitude. We're numbing the paws by poking the base of the paw with a fine filament, not one that penetrates the skin or creates any tense sense of pain, but one that does create a sensory response in the absence of cooling. And that sensory response causes the animal to retract the paw away from the filament. And as we dial up the cooling power, we have to push harder and harder in order to cause the rat to sense that pressure and to retract the paw. And so with the cooling, we can increase that pressure threshold for retraction by about a factor of 10.
Are the materials they're made of, does that mean that they would have to be removed in the future, or can we just leave them in the body? What happens once they're in?
All of the constituent materials are naturally bioresorbable. So they dissolve and melt away in the body. In some ways, they're conceptually similar to a resorbable suture in the sense that the device is present when it's needed, but it's engineered to naturally disappear after that pain medication is no longer necessary. And that's an essential aspect of the engineering, because if the device were not resorbable, then one would require a secondary surgical extraction procedure to remove the device after it's no longer needed. And that kind of surgery is highly risky, because you're disentangling the device from the targeted region of the nerve, especially after scar tissue has developed, could be very tricky. Without it, it would be hard to justify a device of this type.
Brilliant idea. John Rogers from Northwestern University. He published that work this week in the journal Science. Well, up into space now, and there are a few things to be excited about if you're a keen astronomer at the moment. We're only days away from the first pictures coming in from the James Webb Telescope. There's also been an update recently on the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 probes, and we also have a mystery to solve on the far side of the moon. For this celestial roundup, James Titko spoke with space science journalist Richard Hollingham of the Space Boffins podcast.
So, Richard, the time is almost upon us. We'll be seeing the first images from the James Webb Telescope later this month. If the rumours are to be believed, they're going to be something really special. How excited should we be to finally be at this point?
We should be extremely excited. 10 years ago, they started work on this and building it. In fact, more than 10 years ago. There were 344 single point failures on this mission. So many things that could have gone wrong. But now there it is, sitting 1.5 million kilometres from Earth, looking out into space. We know the mirrors are aligned. We know it all works. We know it's sending back data. There are almost certainly those images sitting somewhere being worked on right now. They wouldn't have hyped this and hyped this date and hyped this release if they didn't know it was all going to work. I think the bigger point, though, is that the James Webb Space Telescope is really a step change in what we can see. It's the biggest observatory ever launched in space, 18 mirror segments, 6.5 meters across. But it won't be giving us the visible universe like Hubble does, which is what we would see if we had really, really good eyes. It will be giving what one scientist I spoke to suggested was a snake's eye view of the universe, which it will really be seeing in infrared. I mean, infrared we can take as heat. So it will be able to see through a lot of things that currently block our view. And because it's so much bigger, bigger collecting area, be able to collect photons pretty much, not quite, but pretty much from the dawn of time. And also give us a sense of atmospheres, perhaps around distant planets, distant worlds. I mean, we don't actually know what it'll be able to do. Same with Hubble, really. They didn't really know its capabilities until they stuck it up there and started saying, wow, we can see this, we can see this.
There's also been some news circulating that Voyager 1 and 2, the twin space probes which left Earth nearly 5 decades ago, are potentially powering down. Is there some truth to this?
I think powering down's the wrong word. They are gradually running out of energy. So they have these nuclear batteries on board, essentially generating heat from radioactive sources, converting that into electricity. That's decaying. So they are running out of power. But I just thought I would check. I mean, you know, where better to check than actually from the spacecraft itself? The spacecraft tweets and actually says, while our power budgets will continue to get tighter, our team thinks we can continue to do science for at least another 5 years. I might get to celebrate my 50th launch anniversary or even operate into the 2030s. So there you go. That's from the that's actually from the NASA Voyager spacecraft. I mean, the reality is they are still sending back data, not a huge amount. They're not that many instruments working on them. I don't quite understand why this story has come up now. There's been a bit of a data glitch with one of them, but these things happen all the time with spacecraft, and they're just trying to make sense of that. And even beyond that, Once they do finally die, and they will finally die because they will run out of power, they still really are ambassadors to the stars because they've got these information about Earth and where we are all attached to the sides and these golden records. So Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 will exist, well, long beyond us.
And finally, Richard, there's something of a mystery to be solved when it comes to two craters which have appeared on the far side of the moon. Now, we know they've been formed by the discarded stage of a rocket, but it's not clear which. Is there any update on this?
This is a really interesting story, isn't it? So two new craters. They know now that they were formed on the 4th of March. The initial thinking was they were formed from a discarded SpaceX rocket. That's been dismissed. They're likely to be, but there's been no confirmation of this, from a Chinese rocket stage, a rocket that flew past the moon. And this is all part of the sort of international ambition to go back to the moon.
Does it make you a bit sad, potentially, to reflect on the footprint we're leaving up there? It's not enough for us to just be polluting Earth. We've got to ruin parts of the moon as well.
Yeah, well, we're trashing the Earth. We've managed to put a huge amount of space debris around the Earth, and now we're leaving it on the moon. I mean, I think you have to think, well, the moon's pretty big. It can take it. I think the bigger concern will be actually when we start going to Mars, because, you know, there's no life on the moon. We know there's no life on the moon. But there's the potential for finding life or the signs of life on Mars. And if we keep sticking stuff there, there's the chance that actually that life might have been brought by us from Earth. I think we've got to be really careful when we're going to these pristine bodies that we're not contaminating them and not polluting them.
All thought-provoking stuff. Richard Hollingham speaking with James Titko. This is 5 Live Science with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, we're heading into the metaverse. What is it and what can you do there? Plus, we look at the science of emerging infections like COVID-19 and monkeypox. Now, on the subject of COVID-19, as coronavirus infections surge again, we currently think somewhere between 1 and 2 million cases are occurring around the country every week at the moment. Conversations are frequently turning again to the question of long COVID. It was quite soon after the pandemic began that significant numbers of people began to report symptoms that seemed to persist long after their coronavirus infection had gone away. And this is where the name long COVID comes from. So how many people have been affected and for how long? And who's most at risk? Well, Ellen Thompson at King's College London has found the main risk factors, and she suggests that the number of people being affected sits somewhere around 17%. But if you drill down a bit further into those cases for whom long COVID has a major impact on their quality of life, it's nevertheless still about 5% of people.
This paper aimed to look at the frequency of long COVID within the population and the risk factors. So we looked across a number of health and demographic risk factors for long COVID based on data that was collected between 2020 and 2021. So it doesn't incorporate the new variant of COVID-19 called Omicron, but we do now have new data. So researchers are starting to look at the impact of the different variants on things like long COVID.
And to be included in your study, what did a person have to do? Did they just have to test positive for COVID? How was it that you gathered the individuals you looked at?
The data sets we used were population already established data sets. So what we have in the UK is we have a number of longitudinal studies that track people over time. So we use data from those studies. And we also use data from anonymized electronic health records.
And what actually emerged when you look at the rates of people getting some kind of post-viral syndrome? How many get it?
Around 17% of individuals experience long COVID for more than 12 weeks. But I think what's important to say is that within our data, we looked at functionally debilitating symptoms, those that impact everyday life. We only found that around 5% of people experience those symptoms.
Do people actually really agree what symptoms constitute long COVID? Are we really comparing apples with apples? Because when you talk to some people, they'll say one thing and others will say another, but they're all being united under this umbrella long COVID. So do we really, as a scientific community, have some kind of consistent definition now?
Currently, the definition of long COVID does include a whole range of symptoms that people can experience. But within that, the most common types of symptoms are fatigue, loss of sense of smell, loss of sense of taste, as well as a cough, and sometimes sort of confusion or memory loss within that. So although there's a whole host of symptoms that people can experience, they're the most common type that have been seen within the data.
Did you, though, consider the general population who didn't have COVID at the same time? Because the Office for National Statistics have at certain points published numbers suggesting that when they looked at people who had long COVID symptoms and no diagnosis of COVID, the numbers were a bit similar, suggesting that perhaps what we're calling long COVID reflects real life for some people.
Yeah, great question. So within our study, we were focusing on people who had COVID. So in order to be sort of included in the analyses, we only based it on those who had COVID as a precursor of long COVID. However, we did use some statistical techniques in order to account for the probability of getting COVID. So we feel relatively confident within a certain degree of certainty that we're sort of showing that long COVID is an outcome for people that do have COVID, and there are certain risk factors for getting long COVID.
And what are they?
Female sex, increased age, overweight and obesity, and underlying health problems or pre-existing health problems were predictors of long COVID within our data.
And did you look longer term beyond the 4 weeks, or some people are using 3 months as a definition of long COVID, aren't they? But if we go out longer, is there sort of good news for people who might find themselves in this position? Things are going to get better.
We did look at both 4 weeks and 12 weeks. We don't have the data yet to look longer. Well, I should say we do now, and that's exactly what we're doing. So we're currently planning a study on looking at recovery of long COVID, as well as sort of longer term symptoms.
But does it look like people can look forward to feeling better in the future, or are there people condemned to stay long COVID positive indefinitely?
Yeah, we hope so. There is evidence coming out that suggests that symptoms do subside after a certain amount of time in most cases. I think what will be important is to think about why and for whom symptoms are continuing for longer, as well as think about predictors of recovery. So what's really helping people kind of recover from long COVID.
And to what extent is this exclusive to coronavirus infection? And to what extent do you see the same sort of manifestation in the aftermath of a bad flu?
Yeah, that's a good point. So when we're talking about long COVID, we are specifically talking about outcome of COVID-19, but we do know that post-viral fatigue, for example, does exist with other infections. However, we think it's important to think about long COVID because of how common COVID-19 is and the fact that it's a global pandemic. We need to think carefully about this.
Ellen Thompson, and she just published that study in the journal Nature Communications. In the last few months, there's been more and more talk about the so-called metaverse. The metaverse is essentially a collection of virtual worlds where users can meet, play games and buy stuff. And you do all that wearing a VR headset, which gives you the impression that you're really there in person. But what's it actually like? Chris Berrow from the Naked Gaming podcast dived into the metaverse to explore a series of events that take place on a platform called Outspace. He's got an Oculus Quest headset, lucky boy, but it works for most virtual reality headsets.
Right, headset on. Let's get this Oculus up and running. First of all, I need to get the Outspace app on my Oculus. So I'm just typing that into the browser now. Download now. Oh, so it's free. Gather with people on every major VR headset, attend hundreds of events every month, like open mic nights, improv comedy, and meditation. It says I have to sign away all of my diagnostics, whatever that means. Okay, so I've made my way into this campfire area. There's a moderator over there who I've just had a quick chat with called Rosina, who's told me how the controls work and things like that. So I'm looking around and I can see... Well, the first thing that's immediately obvious is that there's a massive planet in the sky with a rainbow over it. So it's not the most realistic of worlds. There's trees in all different colours. There's red, yellow, green, orange. It's like an autumn setting here. Not loads of people in at the moment. Apparently, Rosina says it's quieter on the weekends. Now, this is like a hangout space where you can just chat to people. I might just go over and eavesdrop on Rosina's conversation with a few other people who are in here. Hello. Sorry, I've unmuted myself. Hello.
Hello.
So every player in Altspace has the ability to build their own little home or kind of house area using a special program called Unity. And Rosina agreed to let me visit her house. So I arrived by teleport and there were sofas, a TV playing in the corner and not one, but two pool tables. Well, of course, I couldn't resist having a go. Oh, missed. Oh, I've hit the side.
That's to excuse my control.
You've gone for a cheeky double there. You nearly got it in. That was a pretty good shot. But one of us is going to have to get one in here. Oh, good shot, Rosina. Good shot. You've played this before. So tell me a bit about moderating, you know, looking after people in online spaces. That's your job. How long have you been doing this for? Because it's such an unusual setting to be doing it in.
So I've done moderating in the campfire only about 3 months, but I've had my headset and Altspace for 14 months.
And you must meet all sorts of people. I just noticed in the campfire, you know, it's like a hangout space. I get there's all sorts of characters, probably from all over the world.
Yeah, everyone from over the world has done there. You would never obviously imagine to meet in real life, so it's amazing.
Oh, your cats are there. What are your cats called?
The black and white one's Molly.
Can I stroke the VR cat?
You can pick it up.
Hello, kitty. Ah, how do I gently put the cat down on the ground without...
You can just let go of your... Oh!
Oh, you've got the cat now. Okay, I've given it back to you. So that was a very unusual experience. I travelled into the metaverse and went to a sort of central holding area
which was very colourful. And then I met the moderator. And from that point, it seems like you're able to transfer into different areas. A bit like the film Wreck-It Ralph. Have you seen that? Where you can transfer into different worlds? Anyway, we went off and played a game of pool. Rosina, the professional, managed to beat me in the end. So, yeah, this could be the future. There's other events. There's a VR church, which is running concurrently with this as well. Lots of different games that are available. It's a strange new world.
Not sure what I make of the metaverse. Maybe I'll dip a toe in the water. Maybe I won't. Chris Berrow there from the Naked Gaming podcast. In the next half an hour, I'm joined by Julia Ravey.
As if anyone needed reminding, for the last 2 years, the world has been in thrall to the COVID-19 pandemic.
And before that, a huge outbreak of Zika virus that was linked to birth defects hit Central and South America and then rapidly spread to other countries around the world.
A couple of years before that happened, the world saw the first cases of Ebola outside of Africa and the largest recorded outbreak of the disease within the continent itself.
And shortly before that, swine flu swept the globe, hot on the heels of the original SARS virus that came out of China in late 2002 and also spread internationally. Now, outbreaks like these are intensifying both in frequency and in impact. But why? Well, this week we're going to explore the causes and the consequences of emerging viral infections like these. And Jonathan Ball is a virologist at the University of Nottingham. And hopefully, Jonathan, you can tell us what actually is an emerging infection. What does that mean?
Okay, well, an emerging infection, Chris, is something, an infection that has suddenly appeared within a population. Or sometimes we can think of emerging infections as something that has been infecting humans for quite some time, but it suddenly gets introduced into a new geographical range, for example. So generally we think of them as new kids on the block, as it were.
And where do most of them come from? When we've got a new entity, it didn't just pop into existence, it must have come from somewhere. So where do most of them appear from?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And so if we think about the novel infections, so the unknown infections, for example, things like SARS coronavirus, MERS coronavirus, and indeed the recent SARS-2, these are viruses which have been circulating in animals, we think in bats, and they may well find their way into what we call an intermediate species. So this is a species that acts as a kind of gateway into humans. So the virus jumps from the bats potentially into this intermediate species and then into humans. And if the virus is able to infect and replicate and then transmit in humans, then that virus can then start to explore humans as a new host. Now, sometimes the virus needs to gain some mutations to be able to do that, but sometimes the virus is pretty much ready to go, and we think that's certainly the case for the related SARS viruses. And so that's one example of a virus popping out of an animal host into humans, and we can think of HIV as being very similar, also Ebola virus. But if we think about things like Zika, for example, what we see there is a virus that has expanded its range. So it's gone to new geographical locations. And so what's happened is the virus has been circulating for a very long time in Africa, also in the equatorial ranges within Asia. And then something's happened that has allowed that virus to then transmit across the Pacific Ocean and then find its way to Central and South American shores. And so it's these sorts of activities, also things like climate change, etc., that allow the viruses to expand their geographical range and their geographical host. So as the climate, the globe warms, so the insects that carry many of these infections like chikungunya virus, dengue virus, these are all viruses that rely on insects to spread them. And as the global temperatures warm, the insect ranges increase, and therefore you get the viruses introduced into populations.
So it sounds to me, really, that you're saying there are possibly three things going on. One is that we, in some way, bring ourselves into contact with where a virus naturally is, or we move the virus to somewhere else, or something else changes which encourages an animal or a thing that has the virus to move. But either way, it ends up with the virus, or where it is, rubbing up against us, and that gives it the chance to jump.
Yeah, absolutely. And so if you think about human populations have increased significantly, also because of that, we then need more resources. We've started to encroach on wildlife habitats. What that does is bring us into close contact with animals that we wouldn't have normally come into contact with. And of course, not just us, but also the animals that we've domesticated and tamed. So for example, livestock. So it's this encroachment upon habitats, but also the globalization. So the fact that we can travel huge distances and the fact that we ship goods over huge distances has given not only the viruses, but sometimes the insects that the viruses rely on, the opportunity to explore new domains and new realms and new human populations.
Yes, I did read the headline when the World Cup came to South America, and they were saying fever pitch because of the worry about people moving en masse by the million to go and watch World Cup games. But I suppose it's that mass movement that has the potential, just very briefly, to amplify these sorts of outbreaks.
It is, you know, wherever you've got people moving over large distances in, you know, very rapidly, then you can see the transfer of infectious diseases following those mass migrations. So we live in a different world than we did several decades ago, and that's why we're seeing far more of these emerging infections.
So worry, isn't it? Jonathan, thank you very much. That's Jonathan Ball from the University of Nottingham.
In mid-May, alarm bells began to ring among public health practitioners in a number of countries when they noticed a sudden spike in cases of the rare disease monkeypox. Caused by a close relative of the smallpox virus, it's normally found only in a handful of African countries, where it's naturally an infection of small mammals like rats and squirrels. In this respect, monkeypox is a misnomer. Monkeys are only an accidental victim, like we occasionally are. People who catch the disease, usually after contact with an infected animal, often present with a high fever, swollen glands, muscle aches and weakness, and a pustular blistering rash. So why are lots of cases abruptly cropping up among men in Western countries with no travel history to parts of the world where the disease is endemic? What has changed? So far, 2,000 cases have been found across 40 countries, and very sadly, one person has died. Michael Head is a global health researcher at the University of Southampton and joins us now. So, Michael, what can you tell us about who is getting this infection at the moment?
So, yeah, this monkeypox outbreak is not like any monkeypox outbreak we've seen before. Usually they've been quite small in number and have been restricted to the parts of sub-Saharan Africa that you mentioned just then, particularly Nigeria and Ghana, or sometimes the Democratic Republic of Congo. Here, the index case, that first case of this outbreak, will almost certainly have had a travel history with those parts of the world. We may or may not have detected the index case here. It may be that it went under the radar. But it's almost certain that they will have come from that part of the world and that they will have brought the monkeypox infection with them. With these cases that have been reported over the last few weeks, they are almost all, if not actually all, linked to these sexual networks amongst men who have sex with men. And the transmission has taken place within those networks. We know that monkeypox spreads predominantly via skin-to-skin contact, or at least very, very close contact. So it's presumably the case that as and when the rashes and the blisters that we sort of see typically present with monkeypox, as they appear on the skin, that will have been the mode of transmission from one person to another. So far, the wider community has not been impacted. So it's very, very different to, for example, COVID, which of course is a respiratory infection where everyone is at risk around an infectious person, essentially, to kind of simplify it. But with monkeypox, you do need that close contact. And within these sexual networks, there has been that close contact, enough to transmit it initially and then to sustain transmission across a few countries.
So we're seeing these cases of monkeypox increasing, but we've had imported cases in the past before. So why is it now that these cases are taking hold?
So there will be a combination of several different factors that are combining here to create an outbreak that appears to be sustaining for at least a little while. One of that is population mixing as a result of restrictions being lifted from the pandemic that we've seen over the last 2 years. Populations are starting to mix in greater numbers. And if you introduce one infection into that community, you then provide opportunities to transmit further, as we have seen within these sexual networks. Specifically with monkeypox, we know that the smallpox vaccine does provide some level of protection against monkeypox. Now, the smallpox vaccine was used routinely in decades previous across the globe, but it's not been used routinely for many years now. So it might well be that we're seeing a reduction in population levels of immunity against smallpox, which is therefore translating into reduced immunity to monkeypox as well. And if there are, again, encounters between human and animal to create that initial infection, then again, the population mixing might mean further cases beyond the index case. So there's a few factors like that that are combining to create outbreaks like we're seeing here with monkeypox.
So now we've been seeing this increased transmission, what is being done to contain it?
So a key aspect of this will be the contact tracing by the public health teams to find contacts of cases and people who might be at high risk of infection. And that is a little bit of a tricky job here, because we do want to raise the highlight the problem to those high-risk populations who are these gay sexual networks, but also we don't wish to stigmatise them. So it does pose a little bit of a problem for the public health teams and, of course, the media and someone who have to report on it. But we do want people to come forward. The sexual health teams who are dealing with this are extremely expert at doing so. So actually within this particular population, we have a population that's probably used to being contacted about possible outbreaks, and certainly a public health level of expertise is used to addressing these problems as well. So that contact tracing will be crucial to reduce the number of new cases, to highlight the transmission and where the risk areas are, and ultimately to slow down the outbreak and eventually bring it to a close.
And now that we're seeing these cases here, do we think that monkeypox could become endemic in other countries like the UK? So if it got into these small mammals that normally carry the disease, could it then just become a disease that's in the background here in the UK?
That is a concern, yeah. We certainly don't know if that will happen or even if it's likely to happen. But it's something that the public health teams, the global health teams, will need to keep a very close eye on to see if it does become endemic in our rodent populations, for example, or in any other small animals. It could happen. It may or may not happen. There's a lot we don't know about monkeypox because there's been so few cases, generally speaking, across the world, and certainly so few cases in Europe or North America or other westernized parts of the world. So again, a bit like COVID, this is very much a crash course in learning about an infectious disease as the outbreak happens. So only time will tell on that one.
Thank you very much to Michael Head there for an update on the monkeypox situation.
This week, we are exploring the field of emerging viral infections. Where do new diseases come from? Of course, we've dwelled very much on human examples so far, but not all emerging infections are human or new kids on the biological block, as we heard from Jonathan earlier. Some are just old diseases in a new form, and flu is quite a good example of that. This is originally an infection of aquatic birds that jumped into humans more recently, and that gave us human flu, but it continues to circulate in its bird host as bird flu, from which it then occasionally makes new forays into humans, spawning flu pandemics. And of course, the more bird flu cases there therefore are, the greater the risk that this could happen. And in fact, in recent months, many countries have seen massive bird flu activity. And a lot of that is down to what we're doing. Ian Brown monitors this at the Animal and Plant Health Agency.
Currently, we're hopefully about to exit the largest ever outbreak the UK has had. And this is a problem that's not just in the UK. It's across Europe, across Central Asia, down into Africa, and into North America.
And I suppose the crucial question is, why now?
So what's happening here is this bird flu strain has been evolving in wild birds, which is its natural reservoir now, and those birds have been moving, and of course some of those wild birds move substantial distances on their normal migration, taking the virus with them, and where they take that virus, it will occasionally then spill over into poultry, chickens, turkeys, ducks, And this virus has a very high lethality. And it's happening now because this virus has improved its fitness. So a bit like COVID has done with new variants emerging, it's exactly the same that's happened with bird flu. New variants have subtly emerged over a period of time, and now we've got a particularly fit strain.
Given that flu has been around for thousands to millions of years, why are we seeing this intensifying now? Something must have changed, which is driving this harder.
Yeah, that reflects a number of different systems. In some areas, we rear and produce birds in a different way to what we used to. There's greater connectivity, there's greater density. So that means when a disease enters those birds, it's more easily able to spread. We also produce birds in an environment where connectivity with wild birds is relatively free and easy. So the virus can move between poultry and wild birds in both directions. Then you've got the dimension of wild bird ecology. You know, what are the effects of climatic factors, urbanization? One thing's clear, wild birds will go through their annual cycle, which involves, for some species, migrating in the autumn into their wintering grounds. And of course, that is a key mechanism for moving this virus.
The parallels, as you highlight, with COVID are quite striking, aren't they? So what you're seeing at the moment is a variant of the virus that's a bit like Omicron. It's evolved to become really easy to spread. But then you've got what we're doing, the human factor, that also hands the trump card to the virus, because we've got loads and loads of animals all packed together in quite high density, intensive farming. And then we've got the vector, which is us, like us on aeroplanes with COVID, taking it from one big city to another. It's going on those wild birds from one hen house to the next.
Human behaviour is obviously a critical part, as you say. Once the virus is in poultry, of course, if we don't take steps to limit its spread from one farm to another or one premise to another, then, of course, the virus is very able and efficient at doing that. And in some areas, not in the UK outbreaks, I might say, but in some areas, they do have this problem of stopping lateral spread, as we say, spread between different sites and different farms.
What's the risk to humans? Is there one?
This virus, in some circumstances, can rarely jump to humans. We've had a single case in the UK this winter, which was through very close contact with birds. An unremarkable infection, very mild clinical disease, and was only picked up through active surveillance. In some situations, people can get exposure to a very high dose and they can suffer more severe disease. And in some cases, that can lead to death. That is a very rare event. And this virus is a bird virus. It wants to be in a bird. It does not want to be in a human. So as a result, it does not transmit from one human to another very efficiently.
But as we saw with COVID, we are obviously still speculating about exactly how it came to be. But one theory is that this being a bat virus, it took people getting up close to bats and putting pressure on the virus, as it were, to jump the species barrier. It got into a person. Once it's into a person, it can humanize. Is there not a risk that it could turn from something which is not very good at infecting humans into something that's much better at infecting humans, and then we could get an outbreak in humans of a new kind of flu?
Yeah, and that is a risk. And of course, that is the theory for the emergence of pandemic flu. But there's two aspects there. Generally, when the virus is able to cross, it's because there's no hygiene measures being taken by those individuals. They're exposed to the birds and their secretions that are full of virus. So they get exposed to high amounts of virus. The second thing, of course, is managing the infection when they are in birds. And of course, it's taking prompt action to isolate those birds and deal with the outbreak effectively. And of course, that's what we aim to do internationally. So it's about prevention of exposure. It's about monitoring those people. But it's about taking action to control the infection effectively in birds. Now, if that is done, you can mitigate that risk. But where that isn't done, the virus has the opportunity to jump into a human and then maybe successfully make that transmission from one human to another.
Climate change is predicted to really shrink the amount of livable land area that we have available to us. And if it's going to restrict our livable land area, that probably goes for animals too, doesn't it? So are we expecting to see more of this kind of thing in future as more people and more animals converge on less and less resources, water, land, where they can live, and therefore the opportunities for jumps, like with bird flu, but other things, is going to increase.
Well, unfortunately, yes, it is a numbers game, isn't it? The more possibility for connectivity between these different populations, the more possibility pathogens can jump. So, and to some extent, that's possibly what we've seen contributing to the emergence of bird flu. Prior to 1997, the particular strain of bird flu we have now causing these international episodes was a very rare pathogen. Now, over the last 25 years, there have been changes in how we rear birds. There have been changes in how we rear poultry and how they connect with wild birds. All of those changes influenced by different drivers, including climate change, where they bring that connectivity closer together, they increase the risk of a virus going from one population that it normally is present in into another new population that it doesn't normally reside in. And that has contributed undoubtedly to the increased scale of the problem with bird flu. And all of that fits into an ecosystem that drives, is good for a virus or a bacteria to spread. It's a perfect breeding ground.
It's a worry, isn't it? Ian Brown, who is from the Animal and Plant Health Agency.
Of course, the most relevant example of an emerging viral infection at the moment is COVID-19, which has cost trillions. This means it's also served as a wake-up call and also a learning opportunity to put in place better safeguards to try to reduce the risks of this happening again. So what shape could these measures take? With us is virologist Vincent Racaniello from Columbia University. Vincent, what are the takeaways from COVID?
In my view, there's one main takeaway, and that is we were caught totally unprepared, and we need to do better surveillance to know what viruses are out there poised to be the next pandemic. We just can't afford to be surprised like we were with COVID. And COVID itself tells us that we can do this surveillance. We are surveilling humans. We are surveilling sewage. We are surveilling all sorts of animals so we can know exactly when and where the new variants are. We do a great job doing surveillance for influenza virus, as you just heard. We can do that for other viruses, but we barely do it. The polio detection in sewage in the UK, we don't even look in sewers in the US for poliovirus. And so, you know, the threat is out there in animals. It's mainly in mammals because the viruses of mammals are the ones most likely to infect us. The most numerous mammals are bats and rodents, and our surveillance of them is minimal. We need to know what's out there. First of all, we need to know all the viruses that are in those animals, in bats and in rodents. We need to know where they are. And then we need to do a surveillance program akin to the ones we do for influenza viruses and COVID. And we need to know what's out there. We need to know at the interface of these animals and people what viruses are circulating. And we have to look in people as well. We have to have some kind of surveillance program where we look at, say, people who are at the interface with bats in the countryside, people who are at the interface with rodents. And we need to know what travel is doing to these viruses. We have nothing of this sort. And that's really the lesson I hope we learn from the COVID pandemic.
Yeah, and we're seeing these increased numbers of cases of monkeypox now. So if we were more widely surveying different viruses in different animals, do you think these cases we're seeing now could have been prevented?
It depends on how extensive the surveillance is, right? At the moment, our surveillance of monkeypox is really non-existent. We're only looking now because we have cases, but we don't even know which rodents are harboring this. There's very little wildlife sampling for monkeypox, and we need to do that. There's no routine sampling at travel locations. So if we could do that, we would have known, oh, look, suddenly there's circulation of monkeypox virus, and maybe we should look out for it before we have the first cases. So the answer is, if it's done properly, then yes, we could have anticipated this particular outbreak.
And this goes beyond just, you know, surveying these different viruses. There's also problems about accessing data in different countries. So are there ways that we can solve some of the political problems that also contribute to new viral infections emerging?
Well, that's the big problem, right? Because the politics supplies the money to do all of this research. And so the data that we generate has to be shared by everyone. And so it would help to have laboratories in many countries generating this data instead of sending samples, say, from Central Africa to the UK and the US, make laboratories in those locations, immediately put the data on servers so that everyone could access it. And the money to do this is the problem, right? This is going to cost a lot of money. And inevitably, politicians will say, well, what really is the risk of the next pandemic? And do I have to spend $10 billion a year to find that out? And I don't know how to get around the political issues because I'm a scientist and that's all I know.
And as a final question, a lot of these infections arise in countries with less resource. So is there a way that we can equip these countries to be better at surveillance?
Yes, I do think so. And the lesson comes from the Ebola outbreak in West Africa in 2015, where many individuals set up the technology locally in order to do viral genome sequences. Rather than shipping out the samples elsewhere, they set up laboratories, they taught local individuals how to do the work, and they generated the data and they made the local people able to do it. That's what we need. We need to bring the technology elsewhere. We don't want to parachute in and out. We want to bring the technology to them. So I think it can be done, and that outbreak showed that it could be done.
Thank you, Vincent, very much there. Vincent Racaniello from Columbia University.
Well, that's it for this week, but 5 Live Science returns at the same time next Sunday when we're going to be dipping into the subject of ponds. Over the last century, thousands of natural ponds have disappeared or been filled in, and that's robbed the ecosystem of their benefits. But aerial footage reveals where they once were, and if they're put back, amazingly, the original plant life that's lain dormant in the buried sediments also springs back to life. Join us next time to find out how. If you'd like to get in touch in the meantime, the email address 5livescience@bbc.co.uk. Until then, from me, Chris Smith, thanks for listening and goodbye.
What makes you feel physically and mentally stronger?
The act of skating? That's my zen. That's my relaxation time.
That is the question I ask guests on my podcast to discover their secrets to health and happiness.
I see going to bed at the right time as an investment in tomorrow rather than a sacrifice for today.
We'll get inspiration from their achievements and find out how they take care of their physical and mental health.
I think it is really important for us to reflect on what have we missed, you know?
I really hope you can join us. The Joe Wicks Podcast. Listen on BBC Sounds.